Hello, 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 ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to VUX World. I'm donning, I don't know if you can see this properly, should I get closer to that camera, look at that. I am donning Voice Floor's rebranded cap. I did a little video about this last week, or maybe even been this week. Shout out to Voice Floor for the rebrand, it's looking pretty cool. They've sent me some swag, which I am more than happy to debut here. Because Voice Floor are the platinum sponsor for the Unpassed conference, which is happening in June in London. I'm sure you know about that by now. It is bringing together practitioners from across the world, really. We initially thought putting it in London, it would kind of be like a local thing. Turns out it's actually a global thing. There's people coming from all over the world to come to this event. We're uniting conversation design and developers together in one space to further the cause and further the best practice and further the education and conversation around what it takes to create impactful, excellent customer experiences using AI. So if that sounds like your cup of tea, then I would definitely recommend that you go to unparsedconf.com right now. We've just published the latest edition of the agenda. The early bird tickets have been extended till the end of March. And so if you fancy joining us in London, if you fancy learning the best practice, the emerging best practice, the current tricks of the trade, case studies and all that kind of stuff around how companies are using AI, generative AI, more traditional forms of AI to improve customer experience and product experiences, then you need to get yourself to Unparsed, unparsedconf.com. Shout out to Voice Floor for the merch and shout out to Voice Floor for being the platinum sponsor for this year's event. All right, now then, onward and upward. Today, I am absolutely delighted and honoured to be joined by Neris Caulfield. Neris is the founder of Injection Consulting, and I would probably go as far as to say a legend in the contact centre and CX space. Neris, welcome to VUX World. Thank you for joining me.
It's really great to be here, Kane. I am thrilled to be chatting to you as a real expert in this emerging and this emerging field. Yeah, so thanks for inviting me on.
No problem. No problem. It feels emerging some days. Then other days, it feels as though we've been banging the same drum for the last sort of decade. I'm sure you feel the same in certain ways.
100%. Yeah. 100%. So it's quite interesting, actually, that is, because sort of 15, 20 years ago, working with lots of data scientists, looking at deep diving into customer segmentation and propensity modeling and that side of things. And of course, that was hard graph back in those days, and you needed those data scientists to do it, but still eminently possible to find that insight and help customers on their journey. So it is like, oh, we've been doing that, but now we're just doing it really a lot quicker and an industrial scale.
Yeah. So. It definitely seems that way. And so maybe it'd be nice to start with some of your kind of your background. I know that, you know, you've been working in this field for a long time. I'd be definitely curious to get into your thoughts on the current sort of expansion of AI and that's potential to increase that sort of time to value and stuff like that. But first, maybe let's begin with, for those that don't know you, Neris, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so walked into my first contact center in 1998, looking after clients who were outsourcing those services and for lots and lots of different brands. And I did that for 19 years. So I would look after Volkswagen, passenger cars and commercial vehicles for 3 years, Vodafone, Sky, Centrica, Procter & Gamble. And you sort of owned the delivery of the service levels and all the management of the operations and then the client satisfaction and their profitability. So that has always meant that I've had a very keen commercial focus. So anything about channel shift objectives has always been front and center. And then, as I say, because I was worked for a long time in an organization called Broad System, who were then bought by Cool Credit, who are now TransUnion. Mm-hmm. Do you know those guys? So they were sort of that mosaic, all of those sort of profile modeling. Mm. That meant that we were obsessed by data. And that was our sort of bit that helped us decide how to improve our clients' customer experiences. Anyway, I did that for a long time. And then I got really tired because it's absolutely exhausting managing clients in outsourcing and relentless. So I set up on my own 9 years ago, and now I go out and audit contact centers using a discovery framework, helping them on their path to determine what's the right investment around technology to sort of move the customer experience, the agent advisor experience, and the operational experience forward.
Nice one. Brilliant. And from those kind of days of kind of managing contact centers and large contact centers, you mentioned there, Volkswagen and Vodafone, things like that. What were some of the things back then that those organizations were getting right?
Well, what were they getting right? It was always a constant learning curve. There was always this continual improvement focus. But of course, it was very voice orientated predominantly. But we saw the insurgence of like self-service, certainly when we were working on the Times and the Sunday Times, things like holiday stops. So we were getting lots of call traffic coming in for people saying, I'm going on holidays, so don't deliver my paper for 2 weeks. It was really evident that actually those were really unnecessary calls. So what can we do for self-service? What can we do in terms of spinning up a portal? There was web chat. I started a web chat on National Apprenticeship Service. And I tell this story quite a bit, actually. When we started web chat, I was part of the sort of which vendor should we go to for live chat, not bots, right. Live chat. There was 2 vendors in the office.
What was that? Live person and someone
live
else?
Live person and another one. We went with live person. So that was all really exciting because it was affecting a real change. But again, that was forever ago, it seems, that was happening. So, yeah.
Yeah. And the whole sort of, you mentioned channel shift earlier on, self-service. It seems as though that's still what the goal is for many. So why is that still the goal in 2024? Because surely these problems ought to have been solved before, surely. You know, the technology has existed before for a long time. Some companies have been getting it right for a long time. You could look at the Netflixes and Amazons of the world and stuff like that. Obviously, they've got massive, humongous budgets. But like, what do you think are some of the things perhaps that in your experience have been the barriers to getting some of this customer experience stuff right?
So obviously this layered complexity has been added when additional channels have come on, and they've been applied in quite a siloed way historically. So with a siloed application with a separate team usually. So we've got your web chat social media team sitting over there, you've got your email social team over here, and you've got your voice advisors here. So that created sort of this web that then just got even more complicated. You add more channels into it, and then you're creating a load of tech debt that is quite hard to unpick. So you've got operational debt, tech debt, and then you've got customer behavior and how they are used to contacting you. You mentioned Netflix. There's an Amazon. You know how you are going to interact with them, and there's not really an alternative. You know, it's a no service, no touch, no human touch sort of experience. But of course, these legacy organizations have got a base that are used to being able to contact them and have a human experience. So you're trying to do like behavioral nudges or shoves in some instances to try and move them away from that experience. And to be honest, sometimes, you know, like you say, it's a huge prerogative. It's like the North Star. Let's get as many interactions as we can off the voice channel because it's really expensive and oftentimes unnecessary. But then there is that counterbalance to say, okay, but what are you going to do in terms of brand engagement opportunities to seize like recognition of that customer's loyalty and that side of things? So I'm not a massive advocate for completely eliminating the voice channel, but I do see that there's opportunities to move people into a much more effective digital experience.
I remember when I used to do a lot of work in government, and it was right around, I think it was around about like 2012 when GDS kind of began. And they actually had at one point, you mentioned behaviour change and nudging or shoving, but they actually had a team called the Nudge Unit. Did you ever come across the Nudge Unit? Yeah.
No, I didn't have that. That's amazing. Yeah, did they work?
It kind of worked. They were very kind of prolific in terms of popularizing the whole sort of Mindspace framework. They created this framework called Mindspace, which is essentially, you know, the Nudge by I think it's Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler. It might be someone else, but anyway.
I love people that can name authors of books. It's just so beautiful. Yeah. I have no idea.
Well, it's a really great book. And it, essentially, that was the book that gave rise to Nudge Theory. And that was the whole thing that the Nudge Unit, as it was called, used basically to advise government on how they can kind of like persuade or nudge people into adopting digital self-service, essentially. But the problem with it is that it kind of worked. And a lot of the case studies that they demonstrated was like, for example, they would try things like when you send out a letter in the post, put a handwritten post-it note on it that says, please pay today or something like that. And it kind of increases the level of salience and it feels more personal, and therefore it had like a 12% uplift in payments made, something like that. But it was never like, it was never transformational from the point of view of like everybody who received the letter acted. It was just an incremental increase. So it's like the nudge side of things kind of has a place, but then in a world where, you know, your likes of Netflix, you don't have to contact them. Your likes of Amazon, you really shouldn't have to contact them, because they've sort of purposefully engineered their processes in such a way that you don't, that they can cater for that kind of thing. So I'm curious about sort of like, I don't know if there's a specific answer for this or not, but like, I'm curious about your kind of thoughts and perceptions on just how hard should organizations go in terms of their kind of mandating, if you like, of self-service options. I'm thinking about Frontier Airlines closing their contact center, for example. Like, you know, how far should companies go to?
Not that far. Not that far, because that's rude and it's not acceptable, I don't think, for people who have vulnerabilities. And, you know, I always think that the voice channel is as simple as it's there for crisis and comfort. And humans sometimes need to interact with humans to secure that, you know, support during a crisis and that comfort whenever it's needed and why ever it's needed. Frontier Airlines decision. And you know, I think the results then speak for themselves. Of course, they've cut all that overhead cost off, but I think it's netted out a problematic share in their market position. And of course, is there a direct correlation? I'd like to think there is, but how far should they go? They should definitely go a lot further than they are, but that is because the customers shouldn't have to call them. It's oftentimes customers are having to contact because of failure demand, and that is because the contact center usually sits much more of an island, so in an organization. And that cross, you know, that working across different practices and different business units doesn't happen effectively. So going back to News UK, you know, when we got the drivers all in to show them the impact that them throwing the newspaper into a puddle had, they could see very clearly that that was quite an easy thing for them not to do. When marketing get their comms wrong. And so, yeah, I think a lot of it is incremental change, though, to be honest with you, Kane. I don't think there's a wholesale answer. And I work with a lot of customers about what is realistic in terms of their apportioning of channels. And again, you have to overlay the intelligence. Which channel is right for which customer at which time? And that might just well be voice, or it might be self-serve.
Mm. Do you think that the channel strategy ought to be dependent on the customer type or the use case?
Ooh, a bit of both.
Right.
I think a bit of both. So I think that you have to overlay. I think predominantly you go with the customer type and how, you know, their channel of choice and how they want to interact with you, if you really care about your customers. And, you know, there are some clients that will say it's a commoditized service and we want to be completely digital. We don't want our customers to have to interact with us by the voice channel. And we're here as a sort of safeguard available if and when they do want to. So I think you should drive down and recognize that most use cases should be serviced through self-serve or digital. But I think that you have to really understand the customers and what's right for that customer at that point and do that intelligence.
I come across some data, and I forget the source of it, but it was talking about sort of like, obviously you mentioned it earlier on that there's been a proliferation of channels opening up to businesses, so that before it might have been phone and email, whereas now it's phone, email, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Facebook posts, Twitter or X, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what one kind of theory is that all of those extra channels take demand away from other channels, and so you kind of have the same demand, but it's just spread across more channels. Another theory is that actually those channels open up demand that you didn't have previously. And so I've seen some figures that suggest that the voice channel is declining for companies, but I've also seen, and this might be anecdotal from people I've spoken to, I don't think there's any specific studies on it, but I've also heard then rather that the opposite is the case and that actually voice is going up. So I don't know if you've got any insight from your kind of work that you've been doing in terms of the voice channel. Is it growing? Is it declining? What do you think?
It's growing in terms of time, as you would imagine. So as people are working out how to get rid of the high volume, low value, and therefore, so if I go into a contact center and their average handling time is 3 minutes, that means there's a lot of opportunity to channel shift. So because they're just handling too many interactions that should be self-serve. So I think that the amount of time spent on the voice channel is going up on an average, because actually what is being presented to the advisors is much more complicated. And then overall, I think as people start to get to grips with what sort of the Gen AI is going to mean for them, certainly on the email channel, I suppose that channel seems to be the one that's going to become a lot more efficient, which is mad, because like 3 years ago, every time I did a discovery, I was like, kill email, it's a rubbish channel. And now it's like, oh no, it's fine with Gen AI. With Gen AI, it's pretty efficient. In fact, it's almost, you know, synchronous. Yeah, I think it is shifting quite considerably, but I see the voice channel going down considerably in the next 3 years. And I don't really see that there's going to be any need for advisors in 5 years being on the digital channels. So all those advisors that are doing email, live chat, Facebook, Messenger, all of that, I think that will be all taken over by Gen AI.
Interesting. So you think that the declining voice, the decline in voice will be due to the proliferation of Gen AI solutions in other channels. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the expediency that and the efficiency that you'll get in those other channels will make people happier to use them, as opposed to those horrible intent-based you know, bots and or the really slow responses on email. You know, you don't want to use email if you think it's going to take 24 hours to come back. Whereas actually, if it's going to take 5 minutes, then that seems like a very viable channel for me to use and have a much deeper conversation than I can on chat. So, yeah.
Yeah. There is, I don't mind calling them out. It's the Hat Store. Right. And that's where we get our caps from. Brilliant caps, you know, not this one, but this one is brilliant, but this is not the one that we do. We have we have VUX caps. And if you make it onto the podcast 3 times, Nerys, you get yourself a VUX cap as a hat trick. So, yeah. But they have the worst, not the worst service, because the service isn't that bad, but you can only contact them on WhatsApp and email. And they only respond between 8 a.m. and 11 a.m. That's it.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is very bad.
Yeah. So it's like, it's mental. It's absolutely mental. Anyway, I don't know why.
Yeah. I mean, that isn't customer service, is it? That's just a half-assed attempt, a nominal attempt that, yeah, at some point customers are going to interact with us and we have to demonstrate that we'll get back to them at some point. I mean, that isn't, you know, luckily I don't work with customers, because it's really important that they're at a cultural level. Customer is really front and center of that experience and where you want to take that customer experience. And some, like I say, might be, let's go all digital and let's go to that that way. And some recognize there needs to be, for their base, for their customer profile, there needs to be a voice channel available for a human interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned a little bit earlier that something like, what was it? The level of ambition that companies have, maybe closing the contact center is too ambitious. But I think you said something like some companies are not being ambitious enough. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think some are just so, have a very conformist bias. So they will very much align to their known ways of working. So reimagining new is quite hard. And oftentimes, you know, people talk about digital transformation all the time. But the reality is you have to know where you want to go in order for that to even start off the blocks. So I think businesses that can't imagine that, you know, that's quite a cultural thing, and it's quite an exec level thing. It's like when you work with businesses that they're really forward thinking, are really energized, are really imaginative, that's when, unsurprisingly, you see things happen. If they're very much, well, we can't because, and yeah, but this integrates with this and that integrates with that, and which is valid because it's going to take a long time to unpick it all. But the gains are absolutely there to be had. So it feels like, you know, I've been doing this for 9 years, and it feels like now is the time that you really can start to reimagine what your future is going to look like. And there's a clear roadmap for how you can deliver that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a little kind of like a small pet hit of mine. I had Ian Robertson on from the forum about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I asked him this question. I'd love to get your thoughts on it, which is that we spoke about the event that I went to the other week, which I didn't actually go to because I was sick. and there's a similar event to that in October in London. It was the Call and Contact Centre Week, I think, something like that. No, Call and Contact Centre Expo or something.
Expo, yeah.
Yeah, that was it, yeah. I think you were there anyway, weren't you? I don't think
I was.
Yeah.
I was doing a keynote about transformation.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I must have missed you. We didn't bump into each other. But so the thing about that event that kind of, because I don't necessarily spend a lot of time in the contact centre sphere, if you like. I'm a part of it as a byproduct of working on AI solutions, and that is where the opportunity is for AI right now, as far as I can see 100. It and I've seen that since when we started focusing on it in like 2018 2019. So we've kind of been going to some of these sort of like contact center events, and it's amazing to me how the ambition is reflected, or the lack of ambition is reflected, in the vendors that are there. Because
yeah,
the
I
most
know.
Predominant...
I did hear your conversation.
Yeah, did you? Yeah, because the most predominant use case that most of the vendors were talking about was call summarization and disposition code generation, which Ian's answer was fair enough, which is that takes a lot of time and it's an incremental benefit, and so on, which is absolutely true, and I totally concur and agree that it's a benefit. The point I was trying to make is that I think it's just, it lacks ambition and imagination, because we've got technology now that can, within reason, understand next to everything. Not everything, can't understand everything, but it's far better than the intent-based models at understanding, especially longer and complex customer utterances. We've got technologies for decades now which have been able to automate all kinds of different workflows. So there's no real excuse for a process having a big manual kind of process behind it. Yes, you might need humans in the loop to check things and approve things and do something like that, but I'm talking about manual shifting about of paperwork, essentially. So there's no limitation to the kind of things that businesses can achieve today, I don't think. You know, the Netflixes.
No, I agree.
Yeah, the Netflixes and the Amazons of the world not requiring either large or at all contact centers is because they've architected their processes in such a way that regardless of who the customer is, the 70-year-olds with Netflix that have issues sometimes and they can't call, they still get their issues resolved. So it's kind of like, for me, it seems as though perhaps the lack of ambition on the company's side is reflected in the positioning of the vendors, and therefore the market as such tends to be sort of gravitating towards really easy low hanging fruit and perhaps doesn't have the imagination required to think about how they can actually re-architect their entire service model to be more innovative, more streamlined, better for the agents, better for the customers. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know if you concur with that.
No. So in a way I do, but I suppose because I understand the buyer landscape as well, I understand why the approach by the vendors isn't to be hag and scary. It is very much around incremental gains, prove the value. So, you know, auto summarization, I can tell you after call work, which is the bit after they finish the call, that is a real problem. Mm. If you take that down by any degree, one, you're cutting, you know, time for your average handling time, and you're creating a consistency in those data records. So, you know, by having the AI doing all of that for you, you're creating a consistency and hopefully not a bias towards the sentiment of the customer and the next actions for a customer. So, you know, I've oftentimes, a call gets represented and the agent before in the open text notes has written some gobbledygook that is the language that their pod have determined is the right way to shorthand that after call work. And then sometimes the advisor, you know, we've got this regulation that's asked as subject access requests. Mm. And sometimes those subject access requests come in and you think, what has the advisor written on the notes? What might they have written on the notes about how horrible that customer was? And you hold your breath because that has to go back to the customer. So you get rid of all of that. So yes, I think there is iterative ambition. I think what's really important, and I think that's happening now. So what you went to Call and Contact Center Expo, I've been going to for like 25 years now, which is absolutely crazy. But last year I went over to Enterprise Connect, which is in Florida, in Orlando, and it's vast of all those same vendors. But I've been following it quite closely this year, and they do seem to be being much more ambitious in their telling. But don't forget, the narrative that suits the vendors is that voice, and I do believe, I'm not just saying this, I do believe voice will stay important. But you automate everything, that's a very different license proposition. Yeah. Then. So, you know, it's sort of like taking the customers on a journey, showing the value, and yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Because it's not only you'll be familiar with the BPO world where their business model is in danger long term, because the more conversations get automated, the more calls get automated, the less requirement there is for the people that the BPOs provide, and therefore if they're charging for bums on seats, that puts a threat to that kind of model. But the, I can't remember who, it might have even been Ian that mentioned this actually, which was exactly what you just said there, which is that the CCaaS and CPaaS, etc. vendors charge predominantly for licenses, which is numbers of people using the platform. And so it's maybe not aligned to their incentives to decrease that too much, because they probably haven't figured out necessarily how they kind of monetize and scale the monetization of the AI capabilities, because it's generally cheaper.
And this is it. They're all really focusing on both workforce engagement management for the advisors that stay on the voice channel and need that engagement. And then they're really thinking about AI, because ultimately we're in this situation where we're going to have a like real arms race against the sales forces, the Zendesks, the Pegas of this world versus those CCaaS vendors. And historically, they've always sort of been bedfellows and integrated nicely with each other. But now they're trying to eat each other's lunch from that license stack. And so it's like, who is going to manage those digital journeys and that insight more effectively? So there's this arms race to sort of get there. Yeah, and it's a really interesting space to sort of sit on the sidelines of and watch, because there's some real lovely innovation going on across both camps, but one of them's going to win out.
Mm. Yeah, it's similar, actually. There's another kind of battle happening, which is very similar, which is the CCaaS providers and the, I suppose, pure play conversational AI providers. whereby, you know, the Amelias and Omelias and OneReaches and Cores and Cognigies of the world who've crafted really great product differentiation and really great products focusing purely on automating conversations. Yeah. And so all of the CCaaS providers now are kind of wanting a piece of that. And so everyone that I'm aware of, apart from probably 8x8, has their own capabilities. You know, Five9 bought Inference, Genesys bought Bold 360, the list goes on. And so they're all building those capabilities so that their clients can have access to AI capabilities from within the platform. And so there's another kind of thing going on there, which is that the CCaaS are kind of almost integrating downward into the AI capabilities, yet the AI providers are now thinking about integrating upwards to bring in their own CCaaS capabilities. So it's almost like you've got the battleground between the CRMs, the ticketing systems, and the CCaaS, and you've also got the conversational AI players in there. And so it's kind of like co-opetition has been the thing that's been, you know, the predominant way of doing things.
I know.
But do you think that there will be an overarching end result to that, like the CCaaS players will gobble up everything and become big conglomerates, or do you think that in reality the market will end up being a mixture of everything?
This comes down to, again, buyer behavior and what becomes really important to buyers, because I sort of split the market up, and I do talk about those players that are inches wide and miles deep, because that's all they do. You know, Cognigy, Core, that's all they do is think about how to better improve and develop AI. But like you said, Zoom are doing it, NICE are doing it, Genesys are doing it. So the customer, what's their preference? Will they make compromises if there are any to be made? Because they'll reach their functionality denouement because it's easier to do so, right? Because generative AI, conversely, is going to make it easier for them all to get to the same place. And they've all got massive amounts of R&D. So I fear for those point solution vendors, or they'll just happily be part of an M&A activity and they'll be sucked up by one, the CRM and the CCaaS vendors. But I'm hedging my bets as to who wins out in the next couple of years, but it'll definitely be those vendors, whether it's CCaaS or CRM, that really get that data to drive improvement in customer experience. And then for the agents the advisors that are still very valuable in the contact centers, it's about arming them, supporting them, and giving them the right knowledge assets to better deliver a quicker customer service.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, you know, there's still a right mess going on in most contact centers around knowledge management and supporting the advisors in a really transparent way. So not all of them, but a lot.
Yeah. And none of it helps actually the delivery of good customer experience, does it? Because, you know, the kind of like, let's say, for example, you're a company that has one of those conversational AI providers, plus a CCaaS provider, plus a CRM, plus a ticketing provider. You've got issues everywhere in terms of really trying to improve that customer journey, because your conversational AI platform can't see what happens when the conversations get passed to an agent. You know, your agents can see sort of like, I don't know, certain tickets being logged in one system, but maybe those tickets don't get logged in the CRM for whatever reason. They just stay in the ticketing platform. So your CRM doesn't see what's really happening with your customer. Your CRM doesn't also see the calls that are happening through the contact center, and the contact center doesn't always see the details of the conversations happening in the chatbot. So it's like, it seems to be as though there is no one solution at the moment to really join up that customer journey. So only when you can join up the customer journey can you really figure out where the friction is to improve it, you know?
Yeah, and when there's tight integration, when it's leading with the CCaaS vendor that is like holding the interactions at the front end, so those call recordings and the digital interactions, and then what's appropriate and right goes into the CRM, because like you say, not all interactions end up into a CRM or a ticket. And as such, and they are often your low-hanging fruit, so they're the ones where you should be driving nudges. So you see your AI has to be able to have a single customer view and a view of all interactions. But there's hard work to be done in those integrations. So the CCaaS vendors work hard to create those integrations, but then, you know, you've got the QM piece, you've got the WFM piece. Yeah, so it's often a very complicated stack. But it's it can be knitted together through integration, but the reality is they're all road mapping at different times and different points. So customers are like looking everywhere, like, what shall I choose? Where should I land?
Yeah, it's hard. It's definitely hard. What are your thoughts on the kind of the future? So you mentioned there that, you know, you can envisage a world where voice declines to next to zero and that generative AI sweeps up a whole load of demand, and that's predominantly the way that customers are getting issues resolved and things like that. What do you think the impact, because I don't think we're, in terms of generative AI, we're very early in terms of tooling. So those AI platforms I was mentioning and all the contact center providers that we've been speaking about, they're all implementing generative AI, some of them better than others. The adoption of such isn't necessarily as widespread as some of the headlines might have us believe, although it seems to be a priority for most. And also the ways in which it's being adopted, as we've discussed, is predominantly, in terms of the contact center, predominantly the low-hanging fruit of, you know, call summarization, disposition codes and stuff like that. So we're really early in both the technology capability and also the implementation and rollout of that technology. So what do you think it looks like in 3 years, 4 years time, or maybe it's even 5 years time? Do you think that in terms of the labor market, what will be the situation to the, on the labor market side of things in the contact center, do you think?
Well, there's two tracks to that, isn't there? There's everybody working at the velocity that you think they should and could, because the technology is there and there's no excuses. And therefore, we'll have advisors or not advisors. We'll have bots in Meta, you know, and they'll be having exchanges that feel very sentient with, you know, bots, and they'll be putting their VR headsets on. That's one way that it could go. And I don't see that as completely unrealistic for some brands and some businesses. Others will just have made very iterative steps. So I think on the, you know, continuum, that's sort of the reality. And it would be lovely to think those people that are making iterative steps have a clear way that they're going to move forward. But Kane, I've been working with businesses that still haven't gone to this notion of omnichannel and putting everything into one, you know, all interactions into one funnel and creating that single customer view. So, yeah. The reality is it's going to be along a continuum, and those that can and will move fast have got loads of opportunities to completely re-landscape what their customer services looks like. And it could be, okay, they're not, what's the word, the long word, amorphosized.
I don't know. Is that a word? Sounds like, yeah, a good word.
Amorphosis is where you sort of create this relationship with your bots, isn't it?
And anthropomorphized.
Yeah. So if you went into, this is feasible, right? I could put on a VR headset. I could go into Meta and have a bot greet me physically, mm-hmm, and talk me through my problem as if it was a virtual interaction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could I do that? Yeah. And
absolutely.
That person could be my customer service bot that every time I interact with my bank, they are them.
Yeah.
So I'm creating this, I know they're psychopaths because they're only faking emotion, but most of the interactions are functional. And it's only then, perhaps with crisis and comfort, that then you divert. You put the human in the loop. So I think it's quite scary for the labor market. I think it's quite scary for, you know, a market that I absolutely love, and I love contact centers. And I think, you know, they're the gateway drug to customer experience in oftentimes, and they're changing rapidly.
Mm. We've got a question from Guillaume, which I will get to in a minute, Guillaume. It's going back to the whole kind of, the battleground in the contact center. So I'll come back to that in a minute, but I want to finish this sort of train of thought on the labor market side of things. Because what you were saying there in terms of it being possible for, you know, you to stick a VR headset on and, you know, you're talking to your bank in a in what feels like a physical banking space, but you're talking to an avatar that's powered probably by a large language model of some description that can do everything you need to do on your behalf. it takes me to, and then that then becomes your banking experience.
Yeah.
In the same way as then for most people, you know, that your app is your banking experience. Very few people these days will go into the branch. Your app is the experience. So yeah. I had this theory a while ago, which, you know, Amazon Alexa came on the scene, and then it kind of ushered in this, at least for me, this kind of, and many others, this potential future whereby we have ambient computing devices that are connected up to all of the services and businesses that we need to access and want to access. And everything is basically just an utterance away. All we need to do is just talk, hey, you know, Monzo, move 50 quid from my XYZ pot into my account because I'm going to the shop or whatever. And so everything potentially is an utterance away. Everything was reduced and boiled down to a conversation. And that was kind of like one vision for the future. And then in order to achieve that, and some companies began trying to achieve that, and one company in particular was Capital One, that and Bank of America and others, where they created digital assistants in the first version of digital assistants, if you like, not the generative version, which many talk about now, which I haven't seen any evidence of yet, by the way. But
no, so, that is a complete fallacy, isn't it?
At the moment, but so Capital One, for example, created Eno. And Eno was the digital assistant for Capital One. And you could talk to Capital One on Alexa, and you could do not everything, but pretty much most of the common banking tasks you could do on Alexa by talking to Eno.
Right.
You could call their contact center. You would be speaking to Eno. It would introduce itself as Eno. In their mobile app was a chatbot called Eno. And they even went as far as having proactive email notifications sent from Eno. So, you know, let's say, for example, you're overdrawn and you've got a bill coming out. Yes, they would send you a push notification on your phone, but they would also send you an email from Eno saying, hey, by the way, you've got this bill coming out. You're overdrawn. You might want to look at it. And then they released a Chrome extension, which was, if you go to any website and you want to make a payment, Eno, in the shape of a Chrome extension, would facilitate that payment for you, a secure payment. And so my sort of theory, I did some work with one of the other banks in America and did some sort of like, you know, competitive analysis. And my kind of outcome of that was that where we're, and this was in 2020, where we're heading is a world where most businesses or an increasing number of businesses have an AI that mediates all conversations across all channels. The first touch point for any customer with any issue is going to be an AI. Call a contact center, you get greeted by a virtual assistant. Go to the website, there's a chatbot there. You know, text them, whatever you want to do. Every single first touch point is going to be by an AI. Most of them are going to try and have it personalized or branded to some degree because it feels better to talk to someone who feels like a person than it does to speak to a bot, for sure. And Eno is a first example of that kind of thing. So my sort of question back then was to this bank, at what moment does it become, because you've got new customers joining and their experience yeah. is going to be just in that VR realm, as you described, in the same way as our experience is only in the mobile app. So some customers in this land of generative AI and in the move towards digital assistants, some customers' only experience with companies, banks, insurance companies, whatever, is going to be with their digital assistant. And if that digital assistant has a name like Eno, at what point does the company itself become Eno?
That personality, that huge personality. And that's the ambition, you know, where you're trying to get to with your advisor community is where they are your brand foot soldiers. They are totally embracing, you know, and I've worked with some great brands where that they can sort of engender that brand persona, that what that, you know, in the way that they speak and all the quality monitoring and everything that happens. But of course you're going to get a lot more consistency if you have this digital persona that people just expect. It's like everybody expects to talk to Alexa, but I feel like my Alexa, when I go around to my friends, their Alexa is different to my Alexa. It's funny, isn't it? It's like we've all got Alexa, but we all have our interpersonal relationship with Alexa. I asked her today if she loved me, and she said, which is a very vain thing to ask a bot, and she said something really cute like, I really value you lots of people, lots of things, but I haven't really worked on human love yet. So I think it's only when you get to that situation, you know, where I think that's totally valid and totally feasible. But I think you and I originally, this is contentious, but you and I started having a discussion on LinkedIn about a pretty well-known bot of a mobile operator who personally, like, I don't understand or really do I care about what's happening in the back end and how gigantic that is of a task as a customer who's frequently engaged with that persona bot. I hate it. I absolutely hate it. If I saw it in the street, I would walk the other side. So that, you've got to make sure that if you're going to put an Eno out there, that Eno is A, representing your brand really effectively, but also is doing a good job, because you don't want everybody just going, we hate Eno.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And that's the hardest part of it is getting it right, you know, and that's why, at least in our perspective at VOX, there is a total lack of design thinking in these solutions. Everything is tech-led, especially now in the age of generative AI, everything is tech-led. And it's a case of just, can we just build it and will it work? Yeah. Whereas, you know, really you need the experience design to make sure that, one, yes, you're delivering a good experience, it's consistent with the brand and all that kind of stuff, but also it actually works in a way that you expect it to. Yeah. And I think that the older types of NLU systems where it's all intent-based, they're inherently limited, and you're always going to have an issue with those kind of systems because they're not going to understand everything, and they can't fail as gracefully as an LLM-powered bot can, because if you say something to a chat bot which is powered by generative AI, it can contextualize that and say, so you say something like, I want to send $500 to Canada, if you're talking to your bank, then it would be a lot harder for an NLU based chat bot to say, I'm really sorry, I can't transfer £500 to Canada right now, you're better off doing this instead. Because, yeah, you know, just reflecting back what you've said to me makes it feel as though I understand you, but I just can't do that. Whereas if that response was, I'm sorry, I don't understand, please can you rephrase, it just sounds dumb, you know. So I think that you're right, that definitely it needs to be done right and it needs to be executed properly. And I think that that's where generative AI can help in that respect, to make sure that even if we can't deliver on the things that we, that customers need, at least we can fail gracefully, so that we don't damage the experience, you know.
Yes, that's a nice expression. And when do you think people are going to use generative AI in their bots? And let them, obviously we've seen examples of that going disastrously wrong with people just implementing without due consideration and excited.
Yes. So that's a complicated question, because the interest in generative AI is definitely heightened. And I've seen something on LinkedIn today, which was a study, I can't remember the company that did it, but essentially they were looking at boardroom calls and executive briefings, basically, and what was being spoke about. And AI was up there, obviously, as you might expect, as one of the most talked about kind of topics. And so it's still something that's everyone's keen on. The issue with some of the deployments that we've seen so far is that, from my perspective at least, they don't have any technology in between the language model and the customer, or very little technology between the language model and the customer. And that means that what OpenAI is trying to do, which is fair enough, it's the wrong approach in my opinion, but it's fair enough based on what they're trying to do, which is that they want to open up ChatGPT so that businesses can implement their own capabilities within the wider context of ChatGPT. So for example, you go to your bank, and if it's powered by ChatGPT, then you can have the banking conversations, but you can also say something like, what's the weather like? And it's accessing the rest of ChatGPT. It's a little bit like Alexa digital assistant, where the Disney built. So Disney have a digital assistant in the hotel rooms in the Disney parks, and it's Alexa, and you talk to it, and it's Disney, but you can still ask it the weather, you can still set a timer, you can still access Alexa's functionality. So that's the mistake, I think, that companies like Klarna are making, and like DHL or DPD, whichever one it was, and Chrysler and those ones. The mistake they're making is that they're implementing pretty much the raw technology without any guardrails around
without
it. So
guardrails,
you need to have a platform in between the language model and the customer to understand the context of the conversation. So then it can say, well, you know, should I be answering questions about the weather? Should Vodafone or, you know, whoever be answering questions about the weather? Should Chrysler be answering questions about Tesla? You know, and the only way you can control that is by having a platform in the middle. And so the opportunity for those platforms is tremendous. I think that the deployment of generative AI will be hindered because of the fact that there's so many bad use cases, a little bit like why people didn't build Alexa skills, because they found out that the data was leaking to the Philippines and now there's a big trust issue. So it's really up to us in the industry to make people aware of the best practice and the way of doing this in a way that's not going to jeopardize your customer relationship, in a way that's going to get you consistent results. Now, I'll just finish on this one, which is that we did a webinar recently with Quick, and they brought along their client Loop, car insurance company in America, and their chatbot is brilliant. It is genuinely brilliant, and that's why, is because it has the Quick platform in between the customer and the language model. And
so
the Quick platform,
small language model, so people call it grounded data, or they call it SMLs now, that's becoming, so is that really what you're doing? You're taking the principles, so because like you say, you can't add enough guardrails on if you're just accessing large language models, and that assurance, the compute, the environmental impact is that dirty secret, but the black box is too difficult to interrogate, isn't it, to determine, you know, if somebody then questions you as the data protection officer or whoever, well, why is this bot now got a bias towards erring towards this? So actually, I don't know, because the black box is too difficult to interpret. So putting a small language model or grounded data in between means you're taking advantage of Gen AI, but you're doing it in a controlled way. Is that
so? The size of the language model is less important. The size of the language model that you would choose basically is dependent on the performance that it will give you against the use case. The main sort of the main issue with the whole black box thing is that OpenAI, even OpenAI, the makers of the model, can't tell you specifically. Yeah, they can't tell you specifically what it's doing and why. And that's because it's so big, there's so many parameters, and there's just too much going on, essentially. The way in which you can do it from a customer experience perspective to get at least more visibility on it is that you have gates and guards in between every utterance. So, for example, a customer says something like, I need to insure my car, it's a Tesla XYZ, and I need to put my wife on the insurance as well. The way that you would kind of do that is, one, you would ground the model in your own data. So that's called retrieval augmented generation. So you have data, you put that data somewhere, and it is then encoded by a vector database, and the language model is used to encode the utterance from the customer, find the relevant content in that database that matches that query, and bring it back.
Yeah.
The danger is that you retrieve that data and you just send it on to the customer, and therefore you don't really know whether they've got the question right or not. So the way to get around that is to have gates in place, other prompts basically, which would say something like, here's the utterance from the customer. Now, here's the topics of conversation that we can discuss. Does this utterance match one of those topics, yes or no? So you've got one guardrail in place there. And if the language model comes back and says yes, you say, okay, take it to another language model, retrieve me the content from this database that is going to be able to solve this query, and it retrieves it. And then rather than just sending that back to the customer, you would send it to another model and say, does this content answer this question, yes or no? If it does, send it to the next prompt. The next prompt will say something like, is this answer in some way disparaging to our brand, yes or no? You know, then the next filter is this, discriminative against other people, or, you know, whatever. So you basically have these guards in place and these filters in place that will not just answer a query that comes in. You basically want to check that every single step of the process you're passing properly. You can't necessarily audit exactly what the model... If the model comes back and says, this piece of content matches that query, and then you go on to the next process and say, does this damage the brand or not? And it says, yes. The content might not damage the brand, but the model for some reason got confused, as it does, and it's decided that this content is unhealthy. You're not going to be able to understand why the model decided that this response was unhealthy, but you're going to be able to say, in this process, it failed because it didn't match brand guidelines. So you're at least able to say there's a reason why we didn't serve the answer or did serve the answer, but you're not necessarily going to get an insight into the model to understand why the model decided to do what it decided to do, if that makes sense.
Are they called mechanistic interpretability?
That's a good phrase. I don't know. I've never heard of that phrase before.
Which is like, how's your black box doing? How's the new, how is the parameter? So you're basically taking billions and billions of parameters and then you're doing iterative parameters through excellent prompt engineering, which I'm assuming is going to be a big topic of discussion at your event in June.
Definitely.
For the smarts that do all that in order to have that assurity. But really, is there anybody that's put that level of guardrails and gates in place from LLM to that smaller model with all those then prompts to then spit out to the customer? Is anyone doing that?
So most of the vendors that I've seen that have these capabilities kind of leave it up to you a little bit. Quick will show you exactly what their prompts are doing at each stage. That's the only example I've seen where the provider is showing you exactly what they're doing at every stage of the process. Some of the other ones, like Google, for example, Voiceflow is another. They have the capabilities where they've got prompts happening behind the scenes to make sure this stuff happens.
Yeah.
But they obfuscate it or whatever away from you, essentially, so you don't have access to it. So that can be good and bad. You know, you need to trust that they've got the right prompts in place that maintains the integrity of your responses. Quick has got a different approach, which is they'll show you the prompts that they're using. So it's kind of getting there. Yeah, to answer the question, the companies do have this stuff in place. Again, it's kind of still early. Google, for example, we've been trying to get a generative bot up and running with Google for a little while, and it just doesn't have enough control. So you can't, there's not enough control over the prompts that are happening behind the scenes for you to properly be able to vet what's happening, essentially. There's this thing called responsible AI, which is, this is kind of part of that, which is being able to show your workings, basically.
Yes.
Which is definitely going to become very important.
Yes. No, it's all super fascinating. But going back to your question earlier, this is why the use cases that are being presented are those that are internally facing, because, of course, there's less risk and there's more ability to just have that human in the loop to go, yes, that email looks fine. And suddenly my 5-minute email is taking 10, 20 seconds because all the advisor's doing is saying, right, yeah, it's auto-summarized. That looks like a really valid response. I'm just going to tweak it a bit and then whack it back out again.
Yeah.
So I think that's why that's where the focus is because there's so much nervousness about the black box, dark art of both prompt engineering, mechanistic interpretability, all of that stuff that is, you know, yeah, these are nervous people usually, especially when it comes to data.
Yeah. Well, you're having real conversations at scale with your customers, isn't it? Like, you can't really be in a higher risk environment, so it's understandable.
And this is why, you know, in the real world, in terms of like operability, like making it operational, this is why oftentimes social media advisors are paid more from their counterpart voice advisors sitting over the other side of the desk, is because the risk of them getting it wrong and their brand representation is just much more public.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. It just needs to be said, I think, that the best approach, this is our kind of approach, which is the blending of the two things together. So
yes,
you don't always need generative AI. Some things are better served with that more deterministic intent-based model. And what you'll find is that although, you know, the experience you had with that provider that we were talking about before, and everyone's had very similar experiences with the vast majority of chatbots. And that experience tends to come when you're at the beginning of the journey and you're trying to get the thing to understand what you need. That's where generative AI is revolutionary. When you actually get into a transaction and all you want to do is, you know, change your address or do something, an intent-based model is actually usually better at delivering that. So I think that the conversation with the contact center people is that you don't have to go all out and have everything generative.
No.
You can use the generative stuff just for understanding what people have said, and then you can use the intent-based stuff for delivering. You can even handcraft the content that you serve. You don't have to generate the content just because it's generative AI. You can have manually written answers to questions. You just use the model to interpret, understand, and find the answer and serve it back. You know, there's loads of ways in which you can blend the two together to create more effective solutions, you know.
Yes. I think that's a sensible approach.
Yeah. So we're kind of just on one time. I'm definitely, certainly appreciative of you trying to join us. I just want to finish on one sort of one question. We've covered a lot in the conversation, from kind of like use cases, ambition, vendor kind of positioning, job market future, things like that. The possible future of generative AI. Lots of kind of topics covered. What do you kind of hope you'll see in the future over the next kind of 5 years? What are you sort of most excited about?
I think 5 years is so far out.
12 months.
The advisors that I sit with all the time, I've been in 6 contact centers so far this year, conducting discoveries and audits, all different types. And, you know, great in lots of ways, but when the rubber's hitting the road and that customer asks a difficult question, that advisor is sometimes not able to instantaneously provide the answer to them. And they get a bit nervous. They get a bit of a sick feeling in their stomach. And this has happened over the 100 that I've done and sat with advisors for 25 years. It's a horrible feeling when you don't know the answer. Mm. And so my hope is that the focus is really around giving Copilot assistance to the advisors to better support them, serve the customers better and quicker, because I think that's a beautiful win-win.
Mm. Agreed. Definitely. Oh, hello. Oh. Is it, who is it? What's the name?
He's called Buddy.
Buddy.
He's obviously like, seriously, mum, aren't you supposed to be finished by now?
Yeah. What's going on? I wish I had Winston here. I should go and get Winston and let Winston join the party. Nice one. Wicked. Neris, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me. Really, really appreciate your time. Where can people find out more about yourself and connect with you if they are interested in potentially working with you?
Oh, thanks, Kane. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm all over LinkedIn all the time.
Nice. Sounds good. I will put the links to your profile, etc., on the show notes and things like that. And thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks, Kane. That was great.
No worries. Thank you all for tuning in. Don't forget unparsconf.com to get your early bird tickets for the world's most loved conversational AI conference, the best conversational AI conference, and the one that you will regret not attending if you don't. Thank you all very much. We'll see you on the next one next week. Thanks now. Bye.